Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Previously on The Rundown with Kyla Mayer.
You can recreate yourself anytime you want to. For some reason, that just hit me so hard. Like, you don't have to be the person you were yesterday. And I mean, not to say the person you were yesterday is someone you don't like, but like, you have that freedom to shut everything down and go on a road trip across the country. Or you have the freedom to decide when you wake up that you're not gonna abuse food today. Like, so you can recreate yourself anytime you want to. We have that choice.
On this episode of The Rundown, we cross borders and continents with professional swim coach and ultra trail runner, Tom Rushton. He comes from an athletic background, but discovered running as a short distance triathlete and has stuck with him ever since. Coaching Olympic level athletes has taken Tom to numerous countries. So he's been running, training, and now isolating all over the world, even in these crazy times. Are you already subscribed to The Rundown, running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to our weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the run community, hear about exclusive events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Visit iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. In this week's news, I'd like to announce the winner of our latest Instagram contest. The draw was for a Cure Hydration prize pack. We really appreciate Cure Hydration for supporting The Rundown, and if you haven't tried their products, you can get 25% off your first order by using the promo code LARUNDOWN, so don't miss out. Congratulations to Sarah B. Cure will be in touch to send you your prize. For more contests like this, please give us a follow on Instagram so you don't miss out on the next one. Make sure to check the show notes for links to information about this upcoming episode, as well as the ongoing protests. There will also be a list of funds and foundations that need your support, so please consider donating to help support this movement. That's all for now. Gotta run. So, like, because of the pandemic, you know, people aren't able to travel as much as they're used to or at all. My next guest actually is getting to travel more than most, but mainly because of his job. He lives out of hotels, coaches swimming, but he's also an ultra runner as well. So I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Rushton.
Thanks, Justin. Excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I know we've got to meet a few times through a local run club here in Montreal, but you're never in town long enough for me to sit down and have an interview with you. So that's kind of just the way it goes for you, I guess, eh?
Yeah, I'm always the guy passing through, and you know, I'm always excited to, you know, be able to connect and reconnect with people coming through. And it's kind of funny because I always consider all these run groups that I join in around the world to be like, I'm a regular, and then in reality I'm there once or twice a year. But for me, it's like just as exciting and I'm always just as happy to be there. So
for sure. Can you just talk about, you know, how the pandemic's been for you? I know your job requires you to travel a lot, being a professional swim coach and, you know, competing all different parts of the world. Can you just maybe share a bit of that experience and, you know, what travel has been like for you and, you know, how traveling's been different in general?
Yeah, I guess there's not really, I could jump in with the pandemic, but I guess I'll provide some kind of backstory and that. So I coach a professional swim team called Energy Standard, and we're based out of Turkey. We train a lot out of the Gloria Sports Arena, who they've been really good supporters of our program. And that's a fantastic location to come and do some training if you're even for, you know, not just for swimming, but we have a great track there. And a lot of the top European Olympians will come and train. So that's kind of my normal day to day is training in Turkey, and competing, like you said, around the world. So we had a season ender in Las Vegas in December, and then I was back in Vancouver for a few days. Then I went to Hong Kong and then into South Africa in January. I was supposed to race again in Hong Kong at the end of January after we had a competition in Luxembourg. But that's when, for me, coronavirus stuff started kicking off, because I was supposed to race a 50-mile in Hong Kong, like I said, at the end of January, and that was canceled. But at that moment, coronavirus was still kind of a little bit of a, you know, an Asian Chinese thing that the world had begun to pay attention to, but it definitely wasn't what it is now. So instead of that, I went back to the US for a week. And then I was back in February, back for 2 weeks in Turkey. And then we had a training camp in Naples in the middle of February. And if you can cast your minds back, being in Italy in the middle of February was probably not the ideal place to be. So we had a week there, and every day the coronavirus, which was in, it was in northern Italy, but it was getting bigger and bigger. And we were watching the news and considering, should we leave, should we stay? But we, I mean, our team, our swimmers and our team are the most high profile athletes in the sport. And so sometimes we have to be a little bit aware of how our actions will be perceived by the news and such. And we thought, you know, if we pull the plug, it looks bad for the people who are hosting us in Naples. You know, it sends a message to all of the swimmers that, you know, this isn't a good situation. So we decided to stay. And then part of the deal with my job usually is that I'll get a little bit of a few days off. And when I started that, I decided I was going to make my kind of European base out in Chamonix in France, because I do like to trail run and just seemed like a great place. And I didn't know anybody there at the time, but now I have a really good, one of my worldwide running clubs, the Wild Trail Chamonix guys, and I like to connect with them. So I went out there just for the weekend on my way back to Turkey. And then when I was there, I got stuck, because you fly in to get to Chamonix, you fly into Geneva. And when I tried to leave, I was told that I couldn't fly out of Switzerland into Turkey because I had been in Italy, and I had to go 14 days of self-isolation in France. And at that time, like, the word self-isolation and quarantine were things that you just didn't, nobody had even talked about it. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a big shock. I went back. I have a good relationship with the hotel guy there. And so he laughed at me, because every time I go there, I end up staying for longer. It's a great place. And, you know, and he laughed at me, because he had previously said, as I was leaving, he was like, "You actually leaving this time?" I'm like, no, I'm actually going. And then I called him from the airport, and I was like, so not going anywhere. Mm. And, you know, the first week of that was fine, because there were no issues in France. And then things started to get real, and everything started really kicking off. And so the second week was super stressful. This year, I had hoped to race the CCC, the 100-kilometer race out in Chamonix. That was kind of my A race as a runner. And I was training really well. I was super fit in the middle of March, and I was just feeling really good about everything. But yeah, middle of March hit, and that week, everything started to become very stressful, and things didn't exactly unfold as planned. So I managed to get back to Turkey on the Sunday, which was the only day that I was able to get out, because the next day they closed Turkey to France as well. So I was quite lucky that I was able to kind of sneak through. And then I spent 36 hours in Turkey before we made the decision to close down the program and ship everybody home. But I don't have home. I live out of hotels. So I just kind of found any ticket to Canada, landed in Toronto. I figured once I get back to Canada, I'd figure things out. And my girlfriend lives in Michigan, and she drove up, and she picked me up, and we kind of reconvened and said, okay, now what are we going to do? And we decided to drive out to my mom's place in Nova Scotia. Hmm. So I spent the time in Nova Scotia. But on the way, we decided, I can't sit still. I can't do nothing. It's just, I can't do that.
You take that, you take way out there. You take that to a whole new level though, Tom.
You're not the first person to say that. Yeah, I can't just do nothing. So we on the way out, I stopped in Montreal, and I think I messaged people. I was like, let's go for a run. And everyone was like, you've been in like how many countries in the last 3 days? We don't know if that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And which is fair. But on the way out in Montreal, I actually bought a Sprinter van, and then we continued to my mom's, and I spent the next maybe 10 weeks fixing that up, and then did a little road trip in that. A little road trip. I drove to Vancouver and then up into the Rockies and back. So it was about 17,000 kilometers.
But wow.
Yeah, it seemed like it wasn't much travel because I wasn't flying anywhere.
Right.
And then I flew down to Michigan and then back to Turkey at the end of August. And now I'm in Hungary. So
jeez.
Not much travel really since March.
So When you closed the program, you decided to close it for how long? Like, what did you have, or was it like an ongoing, like it was an ongoing target or?
Yeah, well, we didn't know what was going on, and we were trying to make decisions, and we would make a decision, and then for instance, the first night that I got back, it was a massive storm, and we had a staff meeting and decided, and we even had contingency plans, and we decided that we're going to stay. Like I said, we have a great relationship with the hotel and everything we need there, and because of the bad storm, I went, I did my run on the treadmill, and then the other staff came up and found me on the treadmill, and they're like, okay, so now we have one of our coaches is from Britain and two of our swimmers, and they were now closing, so they had to get out within 24 hours. And so that night I was like, okay, you guys go, I'll hold down the fort here. We had some Ukrainian and South African swimmers that strongly felt that they were better where we were than going back. And then by the next morning, it was like, no, we just have to get everyone out because hotels were closing and nobody had any control of the situation. And so if we had, and it was fortuitous because it did end up being forced to close the hotel a few days later. So, but if that had happened, we would have been not in a great situation. So,
right. And so how many staff, like logistically, it must be a nightmare, but how many staff are we talking and athletes too?
Yeah, it is. It was a nightmare. That was by far the most stressful few days of work I've ever had. It was a big nightmare. I think we have about 10 athletes from 7 different countries, mostly European countries. And then we've got 3 or 4 full-time staff, and then a few, like our physio doctors, they rotate in and out. So we always have one support staff for the athletes, but it's not always the same person. So probably at that moment, there was probably 15 people who we had to get out. And some of them, the Ukrainians, had to get out on a repatriation flight. I managed to get one of the last tickets back to Canada. It was a bit of a nightmare.
How have you, like living through, because, we heard it in March in Canada, let's say, where things are starting to start closing and lockdown, like, most of the people I know or myself, like I wasn't traveling or so it's hard to see like the evolution of it and like how things improve in terms of safety and all that stuff. So like actually living through it and like basically traveling through the whole pandemic kind of thing. What were the things you started to notice like changing as you were traveling? And like, what did you feel safe the whole time, or were there more like, were there times where you were more scared than others, or were you scared at all, or how did that kind of
yeah work? It was actually quite interesting, and I think it's a good question. I do have a little bit, definitely more perspective than a lot of people, but I would say in answer to your am I ever afraid or do I ever feel frightened, I think the most fearful I ever feel is in an airport. I think that the airplanes themselves are normally right now fairly safe. If you look at the science behind the ventilation, the fact that the volume is significantly decreased, the volume of people traveling, and a lot of airlines are using a lot of different methods to cut down in potential infection rates. It's like the actual flying itself is not that bad, but I think the airport is definitely not the most fun. It's not the most fun to be in an airport at the best of times. And as I frequently say, this is not the best of times. So, but definitely, I would say that every country reacts to it differently. And trying to deal with even regionally, like Canada, for instance, when I was driving, my mom lives in Nova Scotia and they have their Atlantic bubble, which I just managed to sneak in and out of a couple of times because I have my mom living there, but I still have a Quebec driver's license. So I was able to prove that I had reason to go between those two locations. Mm. But they're very closed off and they can do that because there's really, and I didn't actually know this before, but there's only one road into Nova Scotia. So it's pretty easy to close it off. And then the same for New Brunswick is, you know, there's really only a couple of entrances. So it's not difficult to limit the people who are crossing that border. So there, once you're in, like it's not really a big problem. Like there are signs everywhere and everything, but it was the most interesting parts to me were, I think I crossed Ontario at the beginning of June, I think. And the sense that I got in many of the smaller, more rural areas was very much, they were very xenophobic. Like there was a lot of barriers set up to stop you from going into the town. You could go through the town on the main road and the highway, but there was barriers set up with either cars or like concrete blocks, and people with, you know, like shotguns or hose literally, or, you know, like, and it was really a strange thing to see. And you see it sometimes on the news, you'll see some, you know, news thing on the TV in the background of wherever you are, but you don't really realize that, okay, this is actually happening. So actually driving through and seeing those things was quite interesting. And then the different rules in different places are very confusing for people who are moving. So like Alberta still had very strict rules when I was out there. Nothing was open. Everything was quite locked down. But then as soon as I crossed the border into British Columbia, everything was open. Like you could go and go to sit at a restaurant. And it was quite a shock because it was, you know, I was like, what's everyone doing? Like, this is wrong. We can't do this. But then you quickly get used to it again. So I spent a few weeks in BC and I was totally fine with it. And then driving back, then I was like, well, oh, I just want to get something to eat, you know? So the changes are quite interesting. And now I would say that, you know, every country deals with it differently and has different rules and restrictions in place, obviously with regards to border entries. And so currently I'm in Budapest. We've organized this professional swim league as similar to the NBA bubble. So we call it the ISL bubble, the International Swimming League bubble. And we have three hotels here on Margaret Island in the center of Budapest. And so we're just here for, I think, 6-7 weeks. And to get into Hungary, we had to do more PCR tests than I think most humans have to do in their entire life. Mm. But, you know, we're allowed in. And once we have those PCR tests cleared, it's okay. However, in terms of returning, I know that there's a few Canadians that are here, and Canada just is a blanket quarantine. Like you have to quarantine for 2 weeks, no matter what. Whereas some countries like Great Britain, for example, have made some special predispositions to high level athletes that are returning from a competition like this. If you have, you know, documentation that you've done all these tests, and then you still have to do tests when you get back, but then you're allowed to return without impacting your training or your job. You know, like if you have to quarantine in Canada, you have to take 2 weeks off work, which is, you know, not feasible for a lot of people. So, but the different rules are very complicated, and it does change a lot still. And it's also so important that I can't keep track of all of the countries that the athletes I'm coaching represent. Or So I really have to throw it back to them and say, look, I can't look up we have a Lithuanian athlete who tried to go back home for a week a few weeks ago, and he had done all the research, but he was transiting in Germany and didn't realize that he had to do a PCR test for Germany. And so, but it's like, you know, you have to, at this point in 2020, if you're going to travel, you really have to do your homework and make sure that you are able to travel to any country you're going to and that you've got all the appropriate documentation, because it's a lot. It's a pain.
Yeah, for sure. So, but in your case, you have to do it for these competitions and whatnot. And
yeah,
it was interesting to see like the London Marathon actually happen. And I've been trying to line up a few interviews with some of those athletes to find out what that was like for them, being in kind of a bubble environment as well, and kind of what that's like. And that, I mean, that's where you see the most success in pro sports right now is when they do have these bubbles where nobody's allowed in, and they're kind of like the NHL did it too. And you don't see many cases, yeah. But then in cases like the NFL, like where it's more open and there's fans and this and that, well, now you see weekly, you see cases pop up and stuff like that. So,
yeah, you know, it's something I think have to manage. It's to me, the bubble concept works if it's policed. So our situation is we had to do a PCR test as soon as we arrived. And then we were quarantined in our rooms until the results came back from that. And we had to do another test within 48 hours. So basically day zero, you get your test. Day two, you get another test. And then you also had to do two before you arrived. So at that point, we've done four tests in 7 days. And then now we're on a schedule where we have to be tested every 5 days. And we are allowed out of the hotel for 90 minutes. So my long run now is 90 minutes. So that's my long run. I'm trying to do a lot of speed work because I'm like, well, what am I going to do? But, so we're here for 6.5 weeks, I think. So expecting everyone to stay inside the hotel for that long is just not practical, and it's not good for your mental health. So 90 minutes, but we're only allowed around Margaret Island, which is in the center of the Danube River in Budapest. So the chances of people getting anything are quite slim once we've got all of the athletes and staff here and you've tested negative. We do have a few individuals who either tested positive before they left, and so we're not allowed to arrive, or in at least one case, actually an individual who had tested negative and did fly, but then tested positive on that first test, so has been in their room now for a week. Mm. And I think it's unfortunate that they don't have any symptoms because they're just bored. At least if you were sick, you'd be, you feel like it was
justified. Feel it's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're like, okay, well, I'll just recover and then I'm fine. But,
exactly.
So I think I do feel really good about what the procedures that we've put in place here. And it's annoying, coaching with a mask on and trying to, maintain the social distance and all of this, but if that's what it takes to be able to get these things off the ground right now, then we'll do whatever we can do.
Exactly. So. And it's funny, like I can kind of relate to what you're talking about a bit, because I took a job in Nunavut of all places during this time. And
fantastic.
We do like a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and we get tested before they fly us up. But when we're at work, even though we're all tested negative, we wear masks. So that ensures that, if you make it, if you don't test, like if you test negative, let's say, and then, you still have like a 5-day incubation period, they call it. So you got to be careful. So we still wear masks, even though we're negative, and still maintain our distance just for extra safety, just in case a case slips through, So.
Yeah.
But it is a challenge, but you adapt like anything, and we're able to work. So I'm grateful for that for sure.
Yeah. We have masks everywhere outside of our hotel. So my personal hotel room, I don't have to wear a mask, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't have to wear a mask when we're outside. So I'll walk to the pool. It's about maybe a kilometer, just so I can take off my mask for 10-15 minutes. And then obviously when I'm doing my runs, I don't have to wear a mask, but
awesome.
That's it.
So I like to take it back to the beginning of who you are and where you're from and were you active as a kid, Tom? Like what's kind of made you who you are today?
I was always active. Both my parents were Olympians, but my family is a swimming family. Both my parents swam for Great Britain in the 72 Munich Olympics. And I was born in Great Britain. I lived there for the first 10 years of my life. And then we moved to Vancouver. My dad was a swimming coach, and he was integral in setting up the Vancouver National Swim Center. And so growing up, I swam, and I was a good swimmer, not a great swimmer, certainly not at the caliber of the athletes that I'm working with now. But you know, it was a good vehicle for me to go to college. I went to Kenyon College in Ohio in the US. And then following, you know, my swimming career, I started coaching because I really didn't know what else to do. I just kind of, it wasn't the easy or soft option, but it was something that interested me. Whereas I had had a few jobs before, you know, as I was in college or as I was swimming, and nothing was really exciting to me. So I kind of fell into swim coaching, but I started at a very low level purposefully. I wanted to start with kids, and I kind of had this career progression idea that I would move myself up and try to go from coaching, you know, very young kids that were not learned to swim or anything like that. But I think the first group I worked with was about 8 to 10 years old. And then kind of moving myself in my career up towards the as high as I could get. So I actually started coaching swimming back in the town that I grew up in just by coincidence, which is Tawasin, just south of Vancouver. So I worked with a club team there, and then I moved to a bigger facility at University of British Columbia. I worked with the university and the National Swim Center there, and then was hired out into Montreal to work as an assistant coach at the center there. And then I took over as head coach for the National Swim Center. And then that program was shut down, and then I ended up in Turkey with this professional team. So that's kind of my career progression. And then because of the way that my coaching was going, I started as a swimmer, but then I took about 6 months where I was just like done. I was like, I'm done with anything. I don't want to work out. I don't want to do anything. But I did have a coaching job for a while in Summerland, BC. And, I didn't know anybody, and an easy way to meet people was to go and swim with the local masters team in Penticton. And at that time, Penticton was, and will be supposed to be this year, but will be again, where Ironman Canada was held. Oh, nice. And so there was some pretty good swimmers there, pretty good triathletes. And so I ended up kind of hooking up with a group of triathletes that included one woman who was at the Olympics and another guy who ended up winning Ironman Canada. So it was a pretty good group of athletes, and they kind of, I was a good swimmer for a triathlete. So they were like, oh, you should buy a bike and get some running shoes, and let's set you up. Let's go. And so I was like, all right, I don't know what I'm doing. So I did start to do triathlon. And I did triathlon for 4 or 5 years, I think. I had better talent for triathlon than swimming. I'm not really big enough to be a good swimmer. But, you know, triathletes aren't necessarily huge people. So, but because of the way that my coaching was going, I just didn't have the time to be able to commit to the training that you need to do for a long distance triathlon, but also, you know, with triathlon comes biking, and with biking and traveling with your bike is just such an ordeal. So I ended up letting the triathlon go after a few years. And then I just kind of fell into some running, and I went to graduate school in Indiana, and I was living in a little house outside of the college town, and there were some trails nearby, and I started running on the trails. And that was really the first time I was able to really enjoy running, because as a swimmer, you're very focused on times and repeats and pushing yourself. And if you go from not running to trying to do that, you just injure yourself, because, you know, it's so easy with intensity or, you know, any type of intensity or speed to injure yourself in running, especially if you don't have the background for it. So when I went to the trails, I was just able to run and enjoy it. And that's kind of, I guess that's how I started to enjoy that. Now I just really enjoy running and trails and trying to challenge myself and find different areas to do that. So
did your father encourage you to go down that path, or did you look up to him in that way where, you know, he was a coach
and then,
yeah. And also did he guide you in cause you went, you know, and taught younger kids and kind of honed your craft, I guess, and maybe tried some things on them, you know?
Yeah. He was a big inspiration to me. He passed away in 2017. And you know, he was a big inspiration to me, but and also quite a few other people. He was kind of the type of coach who would put a lot of things on the internet, and he wrote a couple books on coaching. And I have a website, which is coachrushton.ca, and I just started to put up a lot of repost a lot of his stuff, because so many people around the world keep asking me for it, which is great. You know, it's so wonderful that he was so well respected, but definitely he was an inspiration to me as a coach. And you know, I think most people would look up to their fathers in that way. I did swim with him for a summer. He was living in Greece, and I went out and lived in Greece with him for a summer in college. But I actually didn't really, he never really coached me, and I didn't see him coach that often until I started coaching. And it was funny because at some point when I was coaching for Canada, we had a holding camp or a competition in Singapore. And my dad had coached in Singapore for a number of years. And I was coaching, and they had the local team there where we were swimming at the same pool that he used to coach at. The coach had really been inspired by him and had a bunch of things on of his. And one of my swimmers that was there looked at their whiteboard where you'd write out the session. And on the back was all of these charts and things. And she said, "Oh, look, it's just like you do." And then the coach from the local team was like, "Oh, that's from your dad." And I was like, "Oh, great." Basically, like done exactly the same thing without realizing it. It was pretty funny, actually.
It's inherited.
Yeah.
Was there anything that he taught you that stays with you to this day?
I don't know if there was anything direct that he taught me, because I think a lot of coaching is about working with people and understanding what they need. Definitely he, you know, always encouraged me to be inquisitive and questioning, and to read a lot. And I think those things have made a big impact in my coaching career, but I don't know if there was any specific examples. But definitely, you know, to have an open mind and to learn how to work with people, I think were probably the most important things.
What do you think makes a good coach?
Being a good coach, there's so many different ways to be a good coach, but I think that it all comes down to working with people. I think that there are many different ways that you can be a good coach, but if you can't work with people, then I think you struggle. So I guess that is the for me, the ultimate, but it doesn't have to be the same for everybody. And I think that that's what makes coaching interesting to me, is that there can be, you know, many different paths that the coaches take. And, you know, some coaches are very scientific. Some kind of follow more of the art side of coaching. But they all, if they're a good coach, they all connect with the athlete, and the athletes will believe in the coach's program to a fault. And, you know, if it's based in science, then they're like, okay, well, no, the science says this and this, and the athlete will follow that and they'll 100% buy in. And if it's, you know, based on the feeling and the art, then the athletes will be like, no, coach said this and everything. And sometimes you can look and be like, that's just so much BS, but you know, it doesn't matter, because coaching is about creating belief that you can do something that you didn't think you could do. And so however you do that, that's what a good coach is. So,
did you ever go through something like that where there was something you could do that you did that you never thought you could do?
I think in many ways, like both as a coach and as an athlete, For sure. I mean, running, especially long distance trail running, like I really enjoy, you know, the ultra trail running. And I think that that's just one of the epitomes of something that, you know, most people look at running 100 kilometers in the Alps as something that's impossible. But when you, you know, you put in the building blocks and you convince yourself that you can do it, you know, it becomes a possibility. But even, and as a coach too, I think working with the program that I work with now in swimming, I think if I had kind of met myself 5 years earlier and said, oh, this is what you're going to be doing, I would think, no way, like, I don't have the capacity to do that. Like, I can't work with those athletes. I wouldn't know what to do with them. But, you know, you put yourself in situations that are just slightly out of your comfort zone and you adapt to them, and then you keep pushing those boundaries, and you can do, you know, you end up being able to do a lot of things that you didn't necessarily think you could do.
Is it tough to deal with athletes of that caliber? Cause they're you said they're the highest caliber, in swimming, and Olympians and stuff. Is it tough to deal with athletes of that caliber?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. We have all sorts of interesting personalities, that's for sure. We have athletes are just, they're people, and so they can be all walks of different characteristics, and they can still be champions. But we have some of our, and we have, you know, I would say that I think all of our athletes, if we have athletes that aren't Olympians, it's because they just were too young to be at the Olympics in 2016. But I'd say 50% of our athletes are Olympic medalists or gold medalists. So it's like they're very unique individuals. And they're also from different countries and different cultures. So it's, you know, working with all of these different champions is always a challenge, because you have to figure out what makes them better than everybody else, and also have to figure out their culture. So it's kind of like a double whammy, and also hope that they speak English, which the ones that we work with obviously do. However, sometimes it's better than others. And sometimes you think you're understood when you're actually not. And that can be a problem too. But they're all, I mean, and I think that one thing that I will say is that all champions of that level are quite self-centered, and that's not a negative, but they know what they need, and they're going to make sure that they get that. So they're not willing to accept a compromise if they know that that thing is going to be important to them in some way, which I think is a trait that probably aspiring athletes could look to and understand. Because if you know that, for instance, getting more sleep is going to make you a better athlete, but you consistently choose not to do that, well, then you're never going to meet your potential. But I think, you know, if you're a champion athlete, you're going to make sure that you do those things. So,
yeah. And a question I have too is, you know, and I guess the same question can be asked for, you know, runners or athletes who maybe have plateaued, where like an Olympic athlete is already at such a high level. So how do you train someone to be better than their that level? And so I think there is a parallel between like that and like an athlete that's plateaued, and like how do they get to the next level? What do you think? Is there a secret to that, or a science behind it?
I think we always say that there's no secrets in our training, but obviously anyone trying to win an Olympic medal has lots of secrets, because you can't expect to beat the best in the world if you are doing something that's either not cutting edge or not world leading. It just doesn't work. But winning Olympic medals is by definition in sport is the definition of exploring new territory. So there's always little secrets and such, but I think pushing past a boundary or training, you know, I think when you're any type of any dose of training can be bigger, but at some point more isn't always better. Sometimes you have to look for another stimulus or another way to get a result. And so keeping your training fresh and keeping the stimulus moving over a long period of time, I think is something that can help prevent stagnation or plateauing. So, you know, you might need to do quite a long base period, which might be, you know, we always deal with, or now we have 5 years, but normally we deal with a quadrennial cycle, so 4 years. And, you know, you would definitely not do the same 100% the same training in the first year of a quad than you would in the Olympic year, because in the Olympic year, you're focused on, you should be fit. You should be coming into the season already quite fit, and you should just be essentially making those fine adjustments. Whereas the first year of a quad, you may be coming off of a successful Olympics already. You need to relax a little bit. So one of the things that we look for in terms of like a quad plan is you're doing like the big pieces of training, but also understanding that there's going to be periods where you're more fit and periods where you're less fit. As long as you can, at any given point in a year, be more fit than you were in that point last year, I think that's good. And for me, one of the things I'm trying to sell all of the athletes I work with, and I do, I've started doing some run coaching as well, just for fun kind of thing. But I tell all the athletes that this year, basically 2021, is the first time ever as an athlete that you get a do-over. Because normally as athletes, you go to an event and then you put your effort in and you get the results of your training and then that's it. But this year, you know, you didn't get that. So you actually get a do-over now. Now it's, you know, if you weren't quite ready for, you know, your marathon in April, well, now you get to try again. And so I'm trying to sell all the athletes on, you know, where were you in October, 2019? Are you ahead of that? What could you do? Looking back on last October, what would you do differently? Because now you have the opportunity to make those changes. What did you do well? And I think it's really important as athletes and as coaches that we focus on the things that you did well also, because obviously that's what got you to where you're already at. But what did you do well? You don't want to change those things. You don't want to lose sight of that. And then what could you do differently? What would you do differently if you had the chance to do it over? Because like I said, now you do. So It's a rare opportunity in sport.
Yeah. It's something that's come up in some other conversations I've had. Like the other side of it is like where this was the Olympic year. So the athletes are ready and primed and mentally they're going, you know, and then Everything that's happened, like, okay, we're going to push it a year. Do you think, is it hard for some athletes to deal with at the same time? You know, might see it like, oh, I have another year to train. Like, that's amazing. But some might see it like, no, this was my chance. Like, and I guess age might come into effect there too a little bit.
Yeah. So I think all of those things, age definitely. So some of our athletes that I work with are on the older end of the spectrum, and I don't think any of them have felt like there have been a few athletes that have been like, no, I'm done. But none of ours felt like that, but definitely they're not continuing towards their prime. Let's say, you know, like I don't want to ever, you know, we try never to put limits on our athletes. I wouldn't say that their best days are behind them, but certainly you could look at some of our athletes and say, well, you know, 2014 or 2015 or whatever was really great. And we haven't quite gotten back to that shape. And there are also the younger athletes who, may have been in contention for a medal that now, you know, and for some of the younger ones, they may have been flying under the radar. So they may have, nobody may have been paying attention to them, and that can be quite a good thing and take the pressure off. Whereas now, kind of the secret is out, and you know, people are watching them, so it can go a little bit of both ways.
So, are you self-coached? Like, you do all this coaching, but are you self-coached, or do you have a coach too
for running? Yes. I did try to work with a coach for a while, but it didn't work out that well, and it's nothing I wouldn't say that it wasn't, it was, you know, I think I'm coachable, and I think that the coach I was working with was fine. But, you know, when my schedule is so compact and there's no real flow to it, like I'm traveling always, and it's, I would say that I'm a pretty difficult athlete to coach because of that. And also, of course, I have opinions about my own training because I am a coach. So and I just, now I just coach myself.
Yeah.
It's better for everybody.
how did your running, like, and I want to talk about the coaching, self-coaching a little bit more, but I want to know, like, how did it evolve? Cause you were like doing, I guess, shorter triathlon and stuff to, and then, you know, you couldn't travel with your bike, but how did you get an interest for longer course stuff? And, cause that's what you do now, more ultra style. Was it always in the trails, and did you ever have like a road, you know, experience with the road, and why'd you kind of make that choice?
Yeah. Well, so I really started coaching and running. For me, everything I do is just kind of like my lifestyle. So when I say I started coaching and then I started running, it's because everything kind of flows together. So I was coaching in Vancouver, and you know, it was a great place to be able to do triathlon, and also the triathlon world championships was there. So I dropped in as an age grouper for that. But then as I started to transition out of triathlon, I was enjoying competition, and I liked to push myself, and I discovered trails. And so I started doing some trail races. And at that time I was doing, there's a Five Peaks series that was big out there at that time. Mm-hmm. I did some of those races, and most of the races were, I would say, between 15 and 25 K. I didn't train much. I certainly wasn't really training. I was just going for a run. You know what I mean? Like, there was no structure or anything. I was just like, I'm going to go for a run today, or I'll take a week off, or mm-hmm. whatever. And then when I went to, I think for me, a big change for me was when I went to Montreal, I kind of thought about, what do I want to do? What's important to me in my life? And what do I need to get out of being here? And one of the things that I had written down was, I want to have a group of people to run, swim, and bike with, was what I wrote down. And that, thinking about that, it kind of made me realize that I needed those goals to keep myself moving forward. And like, I'm a very process and goal oriented person. So I won't just go for a run because I should. I need a reason to go for a run. So I had signed up that year, but knowing, figuring that out for myself, I'd signed up for the Trans Rockies race. It's a 6-day stage race in Colorado. And I'd signed up because you have to do, at that point you had to do it as a partner, but I don't think you do anymore. So I'd signed up with my brother. My logic was, I needed to do something that I couldn't just show up and do on the day. I needed something that I had to train for, because I knew at that time I wouldn't, you know, I would just kind of do the minimum and then show up and try to survive. I also wanted something that I could do that was, you know, somebody else was going to help to keep me accountable. So my brother, you know, doing it with my brother meant that I was, you know, I didn't want to hold the team back or whatever. And I had done some longer swim races before, which were also kind of a team effort. I did a swim around Manhattan Island as a relay, which was quite an experience. So I'd done some of those type of efforts before, and I knew that, you know, even if you're not trying to compete at a high level, being part of a team just keeps you accountable. You know, you check in on people. How was your training today? What, you know, how many miles did you run this week, or whatever? And that worked really well. I trained a lot better for that than I ever had. And also, when I went to Colorado to do the race, it's at altitude. And so even just, I went a week early, tried to acclimatize by living in Leadville for a week. That was a really interesting experience for me. Both as an athlete, but also as a coach, watching my body adapt and such. And then doing the race, was, you know, you basically, I think they sell it as a, summer camp for runners, because you run, I don't know, it's like 100 miles or something over a week. So you're getting, and it's at altitude. So it's like just this incredible training opportunity in of itself. And I came back from that feeling super fit and really in love with the idea of running through the mountains and stuff. And so that's, it kind of, everything kind of became more about spending time up in the mountains and trying to maximize the, what I could do there. And I think for the next couple of years, that was my big goal. I had a big back injury in 2016, 2017. So that kind of threw a bit of a wrench in my plans. I had, you'd asked about road running. I didn't do a lot of road running. Obviously the triathlon stuff I was doing was on the road, and I was pretty quick over the 5Ks. I think I was like, I think at the ITU Worlds, I was like 16:20 or something like that on the 5K split. So like, wow. I wasn't bad as a runner. But I never did any real road races. So my girlfriend at the time got a couple free entries to the Sun Run in Vancouver one time. So I did that. And this was kind of in my transition to running longer races. And I thought to myself, oh, this will be great. I've been trying to do these, you know, longer 50K races, and now I can finally do one that I know I'm going to finish. And I started out way too fast. And at 6 kilometers in, I actually thought, I'm actually not going to finish. This is embarrassing. But I did end up finishing. And so that was a relief. But so I didn't I haven't done a lot of road races.
That was a pretty,
yeah, 33:40, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've always had a little bit of speed, I guess, from swimming, but I haven't really done a lot of, every time I've done speed work in the past, I've gotten injured. And actually, I really love Strava, and I love all the data you can collect through that. And I can look and you can see if I have a real good summer, I come off and I'm pumped and I get into, I'm like, okay, now I'm going to start running faster. And then in October, I get injured every time. I'm trying to be better this year. I have some different ideas and plans around how I'm approaching those things, but.
Yeah. Why is that? Do you know? Have you been able to figure it out, or?
Why do I get injured when I do that?
Yeah.
Because I get greedy. I'm just dumb. I get greedy on my training and I'm like, okay, I'm invincible. I think a lot of us, you know, it's probably the reason that everyone gets injured. You get excited, you get greedy. You think, okay, well, I did that. Now I can do that twice or whatever. Yeah, I think, and actually, if you follow Killian, ultra trail runner, he's during the lockdown tried to do flat running, as he calls it, road running, and he has the same problem. So I feel like I'm not alone. You know, it's hard. It's easy to push yourself when you're running up a mountain. You can push yourself as hard as you want. You're not, unless you fall off the mountain, you're not really going to injure yourself.
Okay.
But if you go and you do track repeats every day, then you're probably going to injure yourself. I think road runners know the right dosage that they need in order to maintain, in order to maintain their bodies. But I think a lot of trail runners that try to get in some speed work just go over the top.
So, how did you get through that? Fear. How did you get through the injury or the injuries when you do get them? And does it affect you mentally? Is it tough? Like, I haven't faced anything personally that's really put me out. So I'm super grateful for that. Maybe I'm not pushing hard enough, but, how do you get through that?
I haven't had, the only big injury I've had was not running related. It was a herniated disc in my back. So I guess it was 2015. I did the 50K. Was it called the Quebec Mega Trail? I think out in, yeah. And at that time there was no, I think now there's 100K. So I did the 50K there, and I was feeling good. And then that summer, I'd been coaching out in Edmonton for swimming. And then I was out in British Columbia playing in the mountains. And I decided that I wanted to do a marathon. And I decided I was going to do the Boston Marathon. And then I was told, well, you have to qualify for the Boston Marathon. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. It's in April. And then I was told, yeah, but I don't know what the qualification deadline is, but so there, I was told, no, that you have to do it like within 2 weeks. And I was like, what? It's so far away. So I ended up signing up for the Edmonton Marathon kind of last minute. And actually, I think I got top 10 at it, but I don't remember. I guess it was 2016 that I did that. So I got top 10. And that was, it was kind of a fun experience because I was just doing it kind of just to get the time. And I was like, no, I want to get to Boston. I'm going to, you know, that's going to be my real one. And so I was running and just trying to get as many people as I could. I was chatting to people and trying to get, I guess, if I'm remembering correctly, the time I had to get to qualify was 3:10 or under 3:10. Mm-hmm. But in order to basically guarantee a spot, I was going to go under 3 hours. And I guess that's a big, you know, in running, in road running, that's a, you know, it's a big goal of a lot of people. So there was quite a big group of us trying to run this sub 3 hour marathon. And it was funny because I was, you know, I had this group of people and I was introducing everybody to everyone and I was just hanging out and chilling and I was, you know, having a good time. And as we went through probably 30K, people started dropping off. And I remember there was one last guy and he was slowing down. And I was like, looking at my watch and I was like, I want to keep running with you, but I got to go, buddy. He's like, no, just go save yourself. So then there was a biker that started biking with me and I realized that was because they have like lead bikers for the top 10. So that was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah.
I was all in for this Boston Marathon. And then I herniated a disc in my back and I was unable to run for 6 months, like at all. I could barely walk for a while. I think Jeff McLaughlin, you interviewed, he had similar injury. And, but since then I've been really tried to be a lot more judicious on how I train because I'm, you know, getting older and more fragile. And just because of, you know, when you get a major injury like that, that takes you out of what you love, you realize that you want to spend more time doing that. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm quite vigilant on what I do. And my goal for 2018 was to have my most consistent running year ever. And I ended up running like something like 4,500 kilometers or something like that year, but just easy running. Like I was like, I'm not going to get injured. I'm going to be smart. I did some trail ultras, but I didn't do anything crazy. But now I'm just really cautious about those type of, you know, speed efforts and trying to keep my volume up, because for me, I know when I have a consistently good volume of running that I respond well to that. So those are the things that work for me. And I think everyone has to find kind of their own sweet spot of a balance of training, of base work, of all of those things. But mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it's about consistency being cautious about speed. So
did you ever get to Boston finally?
No, I didn't. So 2017, I had everything arranged. I had the hotel, I had the flight and everything. And
I think that's when I had my first one actually.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I couldn't do anything. I really couldn't do anything. And it got closer and closer, and it kind of, there was like one day where I was like, okay, well, I clearly am not going to run it very well, but I can still do it. And then it was like, okay, well, I'm not really going to be able to do it, but maybe I can just go. And then it was like, I can't walk, so there's no point in me even going. So yeah. But then I didn't really focus on, I haven't done another marathon, I don't think. Oh no, I did one local marathon in Turkey.
Okay.
That didn't end well.
what it like the marathon, people often say it's a race like no other, and it's a different kind of animal, you know, in terms of like road racing. And what did you, was there any like takeaways from that experience that you can share? Because I can totally relate to you when you're talking about, you know, the people dropping off at 30. It's like I've been one of those people as well. So I find it's funny because you can totally relate, but
yeah, like I remember. So, the week before that marathon and I hadn't been like, it was not a focus of mine. Like it was just like, oh yeah, I want to do this Boston thing. So I should go and do a, and qualify. But the week before, I had been in Vancouver, and I was, you know, I'd run up to Garibaldi and done like a 5-hour long run in the mountains. And then I was down and I was running with the Vancouver Run Co. It's another one of my running groups around the world. And we were just, you know, having a good time. And there's some good runners in that group. And when I started the marathon, everyone was so serious and it was quiet and everything. And I was like running. And after about a few kilometers, I realized, I was like, you know, we're not going faster than we went on that social run. I do think that a marathon pace is not hard. When you do it for, you know, 2 to 5 hours, yeah, it's hard. But, you know, to do 1 kilometer at your marathon pace, everybody can do that pretty easily. So yeah, I was like, why is everyone being so quiet? Let's just, you know, keep it chill and everything. And then when I did do another marathon in Turkey, I think it was 2 years ago now. I signed up for it just at the last minute. It was a local, the Antalya marathon, which is close to where we are. And I was like, oh, I'll do this marathon. I had a sprained ankle at the time that I had sprained in a 50-mile race like 2 weeks before. I was like, ah, whatever. Sprained ankle. No training for a marathon. I didn't do any pace. I don't know what pace is. I'll just sign up for it. And I kind of did the same thing. I was like, okay, well, I'll just go and see what I can do. But I took it, like, for some reason, I went into it thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, progress this and do this. And I wasn't enjoying the experience as much. And I absolutely destroyed myself, like, unbelievably. And I think that, you know, those two different outlooks and enjoying it and just being part of the experience. And, you know, anytime you run 42K, it's not going to feel amazing. But, you know, I definitely, you know, it was a very fun experience in Edmonton. Whereas in Antalya, it was not a fun experience at all. Which, I mean, now I do, like, in February, I did a 50K of loops around the hotel that I stay at. So I made a 2-kilometer loop of one lap of the track and one loop of the hotel. And I decided I was going to do a 50K just for a training run, just to kind of, you know, see what I could do. And it, you know, when you do it and just kind of relax and enjoy it, I think it's okay. But when you do it and you start to go, okay, now I'm gonna hammer this, you push yourself a little bit too hard. And it's, well, it's like they would say with a marathon, you got to hold your feet against the fire as long as you can, but you don't want to put them too close. Mm-hmm. And if you hold them too close, it can be bad. So, but yeah, the distance, I don't think is ever the problem. It's always the speed.
Totally. Yeah. It's holding the speed is the thing, right? Holding that marathon pace. I thought it was interesting when you were talking about like aging as a runner, and I'm kind of, you know, they're going to be 36, so I'm starting to think about it a little bit. I don't feel bad. I'm starting to think like, well, maybe, you know, time's running out or something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, that was the reason that I decided I was like, I'm going to do Boston because I'm getting older and, you know, like I'm going to start slowing down and whatever. And yeah.
Do you have anything that, any things you've discovered or ways that you can still train well, but as you get older, it's a bit easier on your body?
For sure. The terrain makes a big difference for me. Like I find that not only is it more enjoyable for me to run on the trails, but I have to be very careful with pavement pounding, so to speak. Like, my legs don't respond very well to a lot of road miles. So currently in our island here, I've already kind of figured out where I can get off the road track and onto just, even if it's just a little bit of dirt on the side of the path, that makes a big difference for me. And just lots of easy miles. Like, you know, my easy miles are pretty easy. I try to keep my heart rate usually under 140. And try to be efficient on that, but it's not very exciting. But yeah, I think that it just kind of becomes, I think that appropriate slow miles becomes a kind of a protector against injury. You know, like you build up that base and your body is used to it. Is it Joan Roach? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Oh yeah.
Joan? He said to me one time, because when Strava began back in the day in Montreal, it was basically him and me, and we just kind of took over all of the segments. Now it's like way more difficult to get segment records
and
in
he
Montreal
just did
and
like,
anywhere. But
he just did Quebec City.
Yeah, he did the 1,000 miles or something like that. Wait, I don't know how far.
Yeah, not Quebec City, but somewhere in Quebec to
Gaspé.
Yeah, way further.
He went
than Quebec
like all
actually.
The way. Yeah, yeah.
1,000 kilometers.
But he once told me, yeah. He once told me, he was like, if you're injured from running, it's because you're not running enough. And he kind of said it tongue in cheek, but it's true. If your body isn't used to the running, then you're gonna get injured. And so what you need to do is gradually become accustomed to the mileage, become accustomed to what you're asking your body to adapt to. Mm. That's always my thing. If you're injured from running, it's because you're not running enough.
So for a marathoner like myself, what do you think the prescribed volume should be? Like, I'm thinking, I've now got myself back to, with work, 2 weeks up north and 2 weeks at home, I've been able to get back up to, like, let's say 100, but I'm trying to slowly build that up, you know? So what would you say, like, in terms of volume, what do you think? Is there a magic number? Or I know everyone's different, but...
Yeah, I don't think there's a magic number. I would agree that everyone is different. And I think everyone is different in terms of what they can handle. If you're a bigger runner, especially running, if you're a bigger runner and you're carrying more weight, you have to be more careful. If you're light and healthy, because sometimes people are light, but they break easily. Sometimes people are light and just kind of bounce around and they're okay. But I think it's more important to be consistent with your volume. So whether that's 60K a week, but you do that, 50 weeks of the year, or if it's 140K a week, but you can do that a week and week and week. And I think finding the point for yourself that your body can handle, and then that will change too. It'll change as you get older. It might come down. It will change as you become more accustomed to running and to work. And it will change if you, if you're varying terrain, if you're running on trails, obviously you're going to be running slower. So always with the trail running, I think it's a better metric to look at time rather than distance. But I think that it's more important to be consistent and also to have a plan around your build. So if you ran 10 hours last week, try to run 10 hours for the next 4 weeks. And then if you feel good, maybe go up, try to run 12 hours. And I think it's not so much there's a magic number for anyone, but being consistent and experimenting a little bit with yourself. You have this opportunity to learn so much about how your body reacts to different training stimulus. And I think everyone should endeavor to be an expert in their own adaptations. Because no matter how good your coach is, you're always going to know your body better. Mm. One big difference between coaching runners and coaching swimmers is when working with runners, when you're coaching a runner, you're always asking questions. You're always saying, well, how did this feel? What did you do here? With swimming coaching, it's quite different because I see every stroke the athletes take because they're just swimming in the pool right in front of me. So I think as swimming coaches, we tend to tell more than ask. And it's something that I've tried to take away from running and bring into my swimming coaching is try to be a little bit better at asking the athletes how things are going and what if they feel sore or tired or if they feel they can do more of those types of things. Because, we all have a good metric on our own selves and how we feel.
Mm-hmm. Is there any like parallels in the training, in the efforts that we give between what you teach in swimming and what you practice in your own running training?
Sometimes the swimmers that I work with, my comfort zone in terms of coaching swimmers is what we call middle distance swimmers. So 200 and 400 meter swimmers, which equates to, probably, the 800 meter on track to a mile. So they're swimming for about 2 minutes to about 4 minutes. And then as a runner, obviously I don't do any types of things like that. But sometimes I will look at sets that have a similar training objective. So a set that we will use for the swimmers, we would go, so let's say 10 or 20 or 30 repeats of 50 meters fast and starting every 1 minute. So basically they would swim 50 meters, which they can do in slightly less than 30 seconds. And then they would take essentially 30 some seconds rest and then come back. And then I'll take that type of session and do it on the track myself. I might do 200s with an equal amount of rest. So for me, if I'm doing say 20 200s like that, I'm not fast enough or fit enough to do 200s holding 30 seconds on 30 seconds rest. But you know, for me, if I can do 37s or 38s, it's kind of a similar set. And in my head, those two sessions are similar. Or for trail running, I'll do it on the treadmill and do 30 seconds uphill on a real steep, fast incline, and then 30 seconds rest and do that, you know, 20 or 30 times. So I think sometimes there are sets that have a similar outcome objective, like those would be VO2 building sessions. But a lot of the time the swimmers are doing more power-based stuff, working on short sprints, like 5 to 15 seconds. In swimming, we don't do a lot of hard, longer efforts, mainly because the races are so much shorter than what you and I do for running. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Strava is another good reason or another good tool to discover new workouts and stuff, which I know I've asked you for some guidance with the treadmill training. And because again, being up north in the cold, I can't run outside, and I'm even limited in terms of what kind of roads I can run on with all the heavy machinery and stuff around. But getting used to the treadmill now, so
I really like the treadmill workouts. Actually, I find that I personally I'm able to. First, I have no idea what kilometers per hour means in terms of running. Like I have to convert. If I write myself a workout for the treadmill, I have to convert everything so that I go from my kilometers per minute pace or whatever, minutes per kilometer, into, I have to convert it all and have a little sticky note for myself on the treadmill.
I'm the same one.
yeah, it just makes no sense to me. And then there's a coach here that I've been running with a few times, and he runs on the treadmill a lot. So he'll be like, oh, what pace are we doing? Like, 12 kilometers an hour? I'm like, I don't know. Why? That's such a strange way to think about it.
Yeah.
But I really like the treadmill. I feel like you can really tune in really well. And especially if you're doing, I think that if you're running a workout with a group, that's obviously the ideal. Like if you're able to connect with your track buddies and go to the track session and do that together, there's always a social component to it, which can be quite positive, and you'll go faster because you're racing people. You know, when you're tired, you're going to push a little bit harder. But if you can't do that, the treadmill can be a great way to continue that work, because you can say, well, if I was on the track today with my friends, I would do, you know, this pace. I'm not able to be there, so I'm going to set up that, and you know, help yourself a little bit by setting yourself the task, and the treadmill will set the pace. All you have to do is keep going. So I really like those treadmill sessions.
Mm. So without like converting the numbers, like I think mine's in miles and it goes to 14, which I don't know what this means. So no. Do you just mess around with the speed and the inclines and stuff and try and figure it out that way? Or because I've tried to get creative a little bit myself and do interval work or one that's maybe already programmed in the thing, so I don't have to push buttons when I'm running or stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm not very good at social media, but I really like my Strava. I spend, you know, put some effort into my Strava, and I try to make training notes to myself all the time. So even on a treadmill run, I will record for myself like what I was doing, because, you know, watches are getting a lot better at being able to track your movement on a treadmill, but it's still not super accurate. So I'll always record my session. And I made myself an Excel sheet for uphill treadmilling. So what I'll do is I'll kind of create myself a training session, and I'll say, okay, I'm going to run, you know, 15 minutes warm up at, you know, 5% interval or 5% grade at this pace. And then I'm going to do 5 repeats of 12% at this pace. And so I'll kind of create it and it'll tell me, assuming that I complete the workout as planned, it'll tell me how far I should run and how much elevation I will do. And so then I'll just try to keep track of those workouts and just try to be a little bit better on them. And I think one thing that I've learned as a more mature athlete is that being better doesn't mean doing more repeats or doing them faster. Sometimes being better means doing the same workout and having it feel easier. And I think for me, that's a real big thing. I'm always trying to learn that, not to break myself every time I try to do an interval session.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Especially when you're doing like these speed workouts, like these track workouts where it's like you're trying to hit a number and like you push yourself to the brink of like, you know, to the max, you know, and yeah. You're right. It's like, no, like trying to do that workout again, but not faster, but just being able to do it a lot easier. That's the whole idea. That's the whole goal behind it. And that can be quite a good feeling too.
Do you find, and if you do a workout that's like 90% of your, you know, like you give 90% instead of 100%, but then you can come back and you can do a real solid long run the next day, there's a massive aerobic benefit to backing up that aerobic workout onto a more intense session. But also your total training volume will be much bigger than if you kill yourself and you have to take 2 days off. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think, and it's so easy as athletes to look at the microcosm, like just look at, okay, I want to just smash this one repeat. But I think looking at, and this is something that I'm frequently telling some of the runners that I work with, is like, you have to look at the week and the month and the year. Like, you know, people can be focused on, well, I'm going to run this much in a week, which is great. But then if you have to take the next week off, then it's not very helpful. You know, I think sometimes, and that Strava is good for that too, because you can do those distance challenges and you can see how far. Now they've actually really started to do more stuff where you can see your, like how much you've run in, say, October versus what you did in September at the same time. And that type of stuff is super. My mom loves that. She's all about her. She just walks mainly, but she is all about, like, on her Apple Watch, completing her rings, and like on her Strava, keeping it. I don't even pay attention to these things as much, but there's like training, you know what they call it? The training. I work with so many different programs that they all call things differently, but there's like a training effect and it's like a pink area that you're supposed to be in. It's like ideal training zone. I can't remember what Strava calls it.
I don't know.
It,
I get mad at my Garmin sometimes because it's saying I'm being unproductive, but I'm like, damn it. I'm working 12 hour days and I'm still hitting the treadmill twice a day.
That's a well-known glitch. It's a well-known glitch in Garmin watches that they always say you're being unproductive.
Like, what the hell is this? You know, you're going to get people hurt, you know? You mentioned early on that you're very goal oriented and you were writing down a goal of yours and it triggered something with me. Is that something you do on a regular basis? You know, do these goal setting exercises for yourself and, you know, is it something you go through with your athletes maybe?
I wouldn't say that with the athletes. I think sometimes with athletes, you have to direct them to entertain what their goals are, because sometimes they're a little bit lost. I have one, sometimes where, especially working with some of the runners I work with, where, you know, the runners that I work with are like us, you and I, it's something that they do and that they enjoy, but it's, you know, they also do other things. They have a job and they have a family and such. And sometimes running is more or less important to them. And so sometimes when they tend to, you know, be busy with work or family, sometimes having them re-engage in a goal setting process can be quite helpful for them. I think for the swimmers, usually they're very process driven and it's almost like protecting them from pushing themselves too hard, especially because they may have families, but you know, their job is to swim fast. So, and they're quite hard on themselves. So for them, it's more about you know, let's just keep it chill and let's try to focus on what you can do today, not where you're going in 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. For myself, I've actually, one of the things that I struggled with during a lot of the coronavirus was finding reasons to run, because my biggest motivators, I have two things that motivate me to run. And this is, you know, in hindsight, is training for a race. It's like an A race. Like I said, I was hoping to do the CCC race this summer, and they canceled it and they will defer it. But for me, once everything started to be canceled, it was really unmotivating for me to continue to push myself, because I was like, well, I don't really want to work that hard if I don't have to. And the other reason that I enjoy to run is when I get to explore places. You know, like we've said, I travel to all these places for work, and I love, it's such a great way to be able to get out and explore a city, is if you can do a long run, but without any means of, you know, when we couldn't travel anywhere, that was also taken away. So I actually really struggled with that. But now things are coming back, and I'm kind of re-able to get back and do those things. But also, I realized a while ago that, you know, while I am motivated by racing and exploring, I think the biggest thing that I want to do with my running this is my kind of mantra, is I want to be fit enough to do everything that I want to do. So, you know, a lot of my friends are quite athletic, and they always want to go and run or, you know, do whatever. And I always want to say yes. But the problem is, when all of your friends want to do something, at some point you're going to break. So my big overarching athletic goal now is I want to be fit enough to do all of the things I want to do, which is a lot of different things. So If I can do that, then I'm going to be very happy.
For sure. How do you find time with your work? Like, it seems that you shared your schedule with me to schedule this interview, and I was like, man, I don't see any openings.
There are not many, that's for sure. I just, you know, I try to think about what, like I said, what's important to me. And actually, one thing that I'm kind of secretly enjoying is this. So right now, living on this island in Budapest, we're only allowed out for 90 minutes. But you're only allowed out 90 minutes once a day. So it kind of becomes a thing. I'm like, well, I got to take my 90 minutes. Whereas normally, if I can run for as long as I want or go out for as long as I want, I don't value it as much. I'm like, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll go run today and I'm tired, maybe I'll take today off. But now I'm like, no, I do my 90 minutes. And if I've finished my, like yesterday I did an interval session and it only took about an hour. And I said, well, I got to keep running for 30 minutes because what else am I going to do? Like, you know, so I can't, like, it's kind of nice to have that limited amount of time. But for me, it is a priority. And there are some days that it just doesn't work. 2 days ago was our first swim meet in almost a year because of everything. And, you know, getting everything set up and preparing the athletes, just there was absolutely no time. I couldn't get out. But most days, you know, I make it a priority and make it happen and just find little wedges of time to do it. And you can usually, and I think it's quite healthy too. One of the things that we've talked about with our sports psychologist is, as staff, you have to make time for yourself because it's so demanding working with these high performance athletes that you can easily get sucked into just working. But if you don't make that time for yourself, you're not going to be as productive. And so I try to use that and try to take that to heart and try to make sure that I am getting out all the time. And it definitely, everyone in the swimming world thinks I'm a bit insane because, you know, most people don't run that much. So they all think I'm crazy, and everyone thinks that, and especially because we have this small island. And I think I've run around the island this week 17 times. And of course, because it's the only place that anyone from the entire swimming world can go, they all see me running around and they're like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm getting the same looks at work. You know, we finish a 12-hour day, and I, just to get volume, I'm running twice a day now. So I'm running 30 minutes. And the gym times are restricted. So I'm feeling a little bit the way you are, where I can only run 30 minutes in the morning and then an hour at night. So I too have an hour and a half per day, but it's on the treadmill indoor, but I'm getting used to it. And yeah, I don't miss too many. Like sometimes I'll miss it in the morning if I stay up a little too late or whatever. But for the most part, I've been religious in my pursuit of this volume, despite being up there and, you know, everyone goes to eat after work, but, I'm going to my room, get changed, go to the gym. And, it for me, it's like, it does create this, like, this mental focus almost. And it's like, you know, that's worth something too at some point, you know, especially if, you know, like for you, you're doing the longer stuff, or in my case, marathons, but you know, where you need to dig a little bit at some point when you don't want to do something, and it's good to still go out and do it, you know? So, I was going to say too, like, do you find that, you know, traveling must be nice to, you know, see different places, and like you're traveling all the time, so you get to run different countries. I mean, saying mainly when the pandemic isn't happening, you have more freedom and stuff like that. But is it also a challenge too when you're trying to train for something, because you constantly have to research new terrain and new courses, like new routes and stuff like that? Or is that, you find that exciting?
It used to be a lot more of a challenge for sure. I think one of the worst training runs I ever did was in the first year that I went on a training camp in South Africa. And we go in January, we go with the swimmers and we train in Stellenbosch, which is a fantastic place for trail running. So I just love it. And I had kind of spied this ridge and I was like, oh, I'm going to go run up there. And I kind of like had figured out my route. But, and this was, this would be 2018. I didn't have the watch that I have now, which now has maps on it and you can make routes a lot easier. And it did not go well. And it was almost 40 degrees. I'm ending up on this top of this ridge line and I'm out of water and I'm lost. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is a terrible idea. So sometimes you can get into situations like that. Or another time I was in a few days off out in Western Turkey and I had done this beautiful route and I had planned everything and I, you know, knew where I was going to grab some more. Usually you can find little corner shops and like take some water and some snacks from, you know, from there. And it was this nice day and I come over and this beautiful like view of the Mediterranean and I look to my left and there's this big mountain with a storm brewing. And I'm like, oh, that looks really awful. Glad I'm not over there. And then subsequently it turned out that my route kind of led me up this mountain and the storm is getting worse and worse and I'm going up and up and I have no idea where my route is taking me because I've never been here before. And I got to the point where I hid in a bus shelter for over an hour, hoping that the storm would go away, and it just never did. And there's lightning all like right around me. And I was like, this is super dangerous. Like, I don't want to leave here. So that's the only time I've ended up having to take a taxi home from a run. So sometimes you get into trouble, but I'm pretty good now at, again, Strava heat maps are fantastic for when you don't know an area. You can go in the route finder, and you know, you can figure out where everybody runs. It's not always the most exciting route, but you can see, it gives you a sense of confidence that that is a good, running friendly place to go.
Mm.
So I've gotten really good at that. And I don't know if you can see people's routes on Strava, but if you go to my Strava profile and look at the routes, there's probably hundreds and hundreds of them, because I just pretty much, depending on, you know, now obviously running around this island, I don't make a route every day, but normally if I'm moving around all the time, every day I'm making, and not just one route, because maybe I try to make like alternate options if I run into trouble or if something doesn't work out. So, but yeah, I enjoy that aspect of it too.
Does nutrition, is that a challenge? Cause you're, you know, I don't know what you eat, like what your diet's like, but have you gotten used to just like eating whatever's available, in the countries that you're in?
Yeah. Because I'm always traveling with the team. Or 90% of the time when I'm traveling is with the team. And obviously there needs to be high quality food for the athletes. So that's never a problem getting good food. And it's usually, most of the time it's pretty, you know, Western, normal, whatever everyone's used to type food. And I'm not super picky anyway. Like I like to go and try sample the local cuisine anyway. So I'm not, but I think that there's a lot of really interesting and, probably quite beneficial reasons and research to be like vegetarian or something like that. But for me, it's just not a reality that I could do. Like I don't make my own food ever. So, you know, just, some of those things, I think I do think they're a good idea, but for my lifestyle, it's just not really appropriate. Like, yeah. So I just eat whatever. That's my diet. Eat whatever.
Okay. That's good. Well, it's good that you're not picky. I mean, that's a plus definitely. Have you ever had a house to yourself or an apartment? Cause I know you travel, like you live out of a suitcase pretty much. Is that,
I had an apartment when I lived in Montreal. But I kind of, when I moved to Montreal, I had an apartment with my girlfriend at the time, and then she left. And from that point on, I just kind of, which was, I think 2014, maybe, from that point on, I basically kind of been just kind of getting rid of things more than accumulating things. So I haven't really had like more than a suitcase. I have a storage locker. Now I have a van cause I bought a van and converted that, but so I have stuff inside there, but I don't have a lot of stuff that I don't use daily. I have things like winter running clothes that are stored and that, you know, when I go back, if I know I'm going to go into some winter situations, I might grab. But generally, yeah, it's just what I have in my suitcases. I used to travel really light. Now I travel with two suitcases all the time, but people ask how long I'm going for. And I say, well, so far it's been like 5 years. So I think two suitcases is acceptable for that.
What has running taught you over the years?
I've learned a lot of things from running. And in terms of, you know, both what I can do as an athlete and what I can see, like I said, I really appreciate what you can, you know, how far you can go as a runner. Like you can look at something in the distance and say, I want to go over there and see that thing and go and do that. But I think for me, the biggest benefit has always been meeting people and, you know, having that sense of a global community. And there's always, no matter where you are in the world, there's always people who run, and you can always find, really wonderful, wonderful people through running. In Turkey, I have this mountain that I run up pretty much every week. And I have this restaurant that I park at. It's this guy, I call him Mr. Ali. And he, every week I kind of rent a car and I drive out there and he's like, oh, hello, my friend. And, you know, like I just met so many wonderful people through running. And I think that's what for me is the most biggest benefit, I think, you know. I think most of my friends, that I have met outside of swimming have been through running. So that's been the best part.
What does running mean to you?
I guess freedom, you know, freedom, being able to do things, freedom of, you know, feeling, being able to move and be fit. Like I said, you know, I did have that injury and that made me reflect upon what I had lost in terms of being not able to move and not able to do those things that I loved to do. But also, there's also a sense of self-efficacy that comes with feeling confident about yourself and being able to move freely. And even in terms of meeting people, you know, I've always been a relatively strong athlete. So for me, I never thought twice about going and joining a run group, because I knew I'd be able to keep up, you know, unless I'm running with Kenyans, I think it will be, you know, be okay. But when I was coming back from this injury, it was the first time that I had actually realized that, you know, I don't know if I can do the run anymore, because I was, you know, in my head when I was injured, I was like, well, I'll just be back at, you know, peak shape in no time. But in reality, you know, it's a slow process. And I realized that a lot of, you know, there's a lot of confidence that comes from being fit and from feeling good. And I think that when you realize that, and you realize that if you feel good about yourself, if you feel good about who you are, it's a lot easier to meet people and to enjoy company. And I think that that's really important for me, not necessarily being fast or able to keep up, but just feeling confident in what I'm doing and confident in myself.
Amazing. And it's always a good feeling to be able to, you know, run with others and connect with others, and looking forward to next time you're in Montreal so we can connect. What's next for you, Tom, and in your running goals, and where can people find out more about you?
I don't know what is next in my running goals for the foreseeable future. I think, like I said, I'm trying to use the next 6 weeks to just develop a really good fitness, in which I guess running less than 90 minutes means doing some, you know, more speed work and trying not to get injured doing that, like I said, and just generally trying to feel like I'm moving forward and able to kind of be a better athlete from my time here. I think that I hope very much that many of my plans from 2020 can be transferred over to 2021. You know, we were really looking forward to going to Tokyo for the Olympics, and I do think that that will be realized this year. It might be different than it had been planned to be, but I hope that we can do that. And then I hope my plan after that was to go to Chamonix for a month and then race. And I hope that I can still do that. So that's kind of I'm looking at that as my next running goal. My girlfriend and my partner in my run coaching she signed up for Tahoe 200 this year. So I'm looking forward to supporting her on that too. And I think, you know, she wanted me to run some ridiculous distance with her. And I said, the most I'm going to do is 50 miles. She's like, oh, but that's only like this much. I'm like, yes, just because you're willing to run 200 miles doesn't mean I am. So yeah, I think those are exciting things to me. That's what I'm looking forward to in terms of running. What's the other part of the question? I forget.
Oh, where can people find out more about you? But I want to know, how is it challenging to have a girlfriend that's not with you in these times? Like, has that been a challenge for you?
Yeah, it's always a challenge because, you know, it's funny because in 2019, you know, we grabbed pieces of time together when we could, and we kind of made a thing. We were like, okay, 2020, let's spend, I can't remember how many days we were together in 2019, but we counted them and we're like, let's spend more days together in 2020. And then we definitely did. We spent a lot of time together because, you know, stayed at my mom's for 10 weeks. And then I stayed at her place in Michigan for 6 weeks. And so that was a success in something which was good, but not in the positive way that we had hoped it would be. But yeah, it's difficult. And I think that as I move farther down, you know, get older and such, and, you know, it's definitely something I don't really want to be always trying to find these fleeting moments of friendship with people, and especially with my girlfriend, and we have two dogs as well. So it's hard to be away for that long. Mm-hmm. But, you know, right now, because, you know, I ironically told her, well, after the Olympics, I'll see what I can do. But then the Olympics didn't happen. So we're still working on that piece. But I do think that, yeah, it's something that I do want to focus more on, building those relationships in the future for sure.
Yeah. And you got to miss those pups as well, right?
Yeah, sometimes, and I tell her this, so I'm not going to get in trouble, but, you know, we can FaceTime nowadays and like we can call each other, and, you know, it's not the same obviously, but it definitely makes a big difference. But sometimes I miss the dogs because they don't really get the FaceTime stuff. Like, I don't know why, but they never pick up on my voice. Like, it's like, so yeah, sometimes it's harder being away from them because I, you know, like you don't get to ask them how their day was, and
Yeah, exactly. So, you're just like, are they wagging right now? Whatever. So yeah, where can people find out more about you, Tom?
Yeah. I do have a website, which is coachrushton.ca. And we do have a running coaching business, which is bucketlistcoaching.org. And then my swim coaching is at energystandardparis.com. Our club team is technically based in Paris in terms of we're licensed out of Paris. Nice. So.
Well, it's been really nice to catch up with you, Tom. Thank you for sharing your story and everything you do as far as coaching in the swim world, but also in running as well. And can't wait to see where you end up next and what your next challenge is.
Yeah, me too. I have a quote on my Instagram and such that it's a David Bowie quote, which is, I'm not sure where I'm going from here, but I promise it won't be boring.
That's a great way to end it.
Yeah.
Take care, man.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Are you already subscribed to The Rundown, Running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to our weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the run community, hear about exclusive events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Visit iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at iamarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram at The Rundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it.
The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in St. Henry, Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi and hosted by Justin Pugliese.